There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I asked the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hello and welcome to Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. I'm Mark Kenny and with me is Dr. Maria Tafaga, Senior Lecturer in Political Science at the School of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Mark. Hi, everyone.
Welcome back after a few weeks having to be in other places.
Yes, no, it's great to be back in the studio. I'm very excited to dig into our sausage.
That's an unfortunate mental image.
Now you've made it worse. Thanks, Mark.
I don't think I'll ever be able to eat a sausage again.
That's right. Overnight, of course, as we record this, US President Joseph Biden bobbed up in Kyiv for talks with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Pretty big moment, this. The trip was immediately compared to JFK in West Berlin in 1961 and Ronald Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate in 1987. Both of those were pretty direct presidential statements by gesture and by words aimed ultimately at Moscow, as was this, arguably. To discuss this, it's welcome back to Dr. Charles Miller, a defence and strategic policy expert, also at the School of Politics and International Relations, and whose voice you've already heard.
Yeah.
Welcome back again, Charles.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So it was a big moment, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, absolutely. I was really quite surprised. I mean, it's quite a risky thing to do. You know, he's going to Kyiv at a point when there are air raid sirens going off. You know, so he's actually taking a fairly non-trivial personal risk in going there. And I think it is a really, really, I think it's really good that he did it. And I think that it actually has a really important effect on the diplomacy around the war, which I'm happy to delve into if you want me to talk about it now.
Please explain, like, why is it important that he show up?
Well, the reason why really goes down to the kind of the logic of negotiation and the logic of bargaining, and essentially, many people in international relations view war as a form of bargaining, and they view diplomacy and war as being essentially things that are on a kind of a spectrum, if you will,
A continuum.
A continuum, yes, exactly. And what Joe Biden is doing by going to Kyiv is he's staking his own personal credibility and the credibility of the US government on the survival of Ukraine as an independent country and support for Ukraine, which means that this changes the bargaining situation, changes the negotiations, any potential negotiations about ending the war, for example, in very important ways, because it now increases the costs that the United States would bear if Ukraine were to be overrun or perceived to be defeated, if you will, which makes it more likely that Putin will conclude the United States will stick by Ukraine, which should in turn have the effect of making, of basically making Putin more likely, if you like, to make more concessions in order to end the war, if the war were actually to end in some kind of negotiation.
Yeah, so I suppose implicit in that is the and we see this mentioned by a number of people right throughout the last year, and of course that's the other point about this. This is, we're right on the eve of the anniversary, the first anniversary of this invasion. But implicit in the reversal of atmospherics, or the change of atmospherics that comes about by Biden's visit, is this notion that that Putin has been kind of banking on the West getting fatigue at some point, that it all just dragging on for too long, and various donor governments sort of losing their patience or coming to the end of their perhaps their financial or electoral capacity to stay the distance. And what Biden has said, and you used the term, you know, in for the long haul, I think, or whatever it was. I mean, that's pretty much what Biden said explicitly. We will stay as long as it takes. Right. So you've got the visit itself, which is a big striking visual gesture and, as you say, a physical a commitment as well. Mm-hmm. And you've got the words, and he was quite – I watched it live last night on BBC. Really? And it was it was quite impressive. I mean, Zelensky spoke in Ukrainian for, you know, a reasonably long period of time. And then Biden spoke. Mm. This was after they'd sort of, you know, signed guest books and these kinds of things, had other talks. And then they fronted the media and they made these statements. And Biden talked about the call that he'd had with Zelensky on the 24th of February last year, and the sort of what he thought at that time. He said you could, you know, Zelensky had told him that there were air raid sirens and bombs going off and so forth, and he said, you know, basically the world was, and these were his words, literally bracing for the fall of Kyiv, for the fall of Ukraine. Well, Ukraine still stands, Kyiv still stands, democracy still stands, and it was in the, he was right in there, wasn't he?
I mean, that's quite, I didn't actually have the chance to watch it, but I mean, you know, that's a pretty powerful statement. That's true. And what's important, again, I mean, is that Biden is not just saying these things, he's actually, through his physical presence in Kyiv, demonstrating these things. And that's very, very important because, you know, like I said, that puts the credibility of Joe Biden and it puts the credibility of the United States on the line in a way that signals to Vladimir Putin that the United States, at the very least, at least as long as Joe Biden is president, is not going to back down in this, which obviously gives a real kind of boost to, you know, the Ukrainian position strategically.
So theoretically, Putin would have to update his calculation.
Absolutely.
And, I forgot my second point, which is really irritating. But in essence, actions speak louder than words.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so he's really sort of followed through.
Right. Well, it's the same thing with Zelensky refusing to leave Kyiv last year, right? Mm. So, I mean, if he just said, you know, if
I don't need a ride, I need weapons.
Yeah. Right, I need ammunition. You know, and the other very famous, you know, when he does this little kind of, you know, selfie video with his cabinet, where he's standing there and saying, your president is here, your defense minister's here, et cetera, et cetera.
And we're not going anywhere, yeah.
Right, we're not going anywhere. Exactly. Now, if Zelensky had said all of the things that he said in the last few years from exile in Warsaw or Prague, that's not really going to have the same effect as
what it's actually had.
Yeah, because he's actually putting his physical, his life on the line. I mean, I'd heard that at some point last year, the Russians had made up to 14 assassination attempts on Zelensky.
Yeah.
So by staying in Kyiv and keeping himself in harm's way, he is essentially signaling his resolve to win the war to the Ukrainian people and to the Russians.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, you're right, like it's a commitment to a vision of Ukraine that is, independent or outside of the shadow of Russia. And if you actually look at the sort of history of the development of Ukrainian politics as a state, it's only 30 years old, right? That is actually an incredibly powerful sort of symbol, and the sort of cynicism around political elites in Ukraine and their commitment to democracy and their commitment to, an alternative pathway, like, you know, a Polish pathway, which, you know, is not exactly 100% amazing, but is definitely a different kind of life to what is available and on offer from Moscow, which we can see in Belarusia, for example. It is a really good example of why the politics of symbolism really kind of matters. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it is like a, you know, you've kind of got your hardware and you've got your sort of soft power kinds of dimensions. And I suppose what I kind of want to know is, you know, how important do you think Biden's visit at this time is in the general kind of context of, like, the, you know, this difficult winter in Europe, the energy crisis and the inflation kind of crisis. Like, do you think it's important beyond the borders of Ukraine as well? What's your take?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it is important in all these things. So, I mean, first of all, with the winter, I mean, it turned out to be an unexpectedly mild winter in Europe, which was fantastic. And the Germans did a great job of adapting to the cutoff of Russian energy supplies. So that actually passed off really without causing as many problems as many had thought.
That was the big fear going in.
That was the big fear going in, exactly. That passed off without anything like as many problems as many people feared. I think that it's important now, however, because if we cast our minds back to when, I think it was last on, the Kharkiv offensive that the Ukrainians undertook. So what happened was that the Ukrainians undertook this offensive. They scored a massive victory against the Russians. And then I think a lot of people in the West just assumed that that was the war pretty much won, right? So the Ukrainians would now continue smashing through the Russian positions. They would expel the Russians from all parts of, you know, 2013 Ukraine. And, you know, that would be it. The good guys are the one we could all go home. But the problem is, of course, that, you know, the Kharkiv offensive, I mean, it was for relatively limited stakes. It was a great military achievement, but it didn't end the war. And so a lot of Westerners, I think, perhaps took from this, well, you know, this is lasting longer than we thought. Is it really going to go as well as we thought it was going to be? So, I mean, support for a war effort, sort of broadly construed, as partly a function of the cost, but also partly a function of the prospects for success. Mm. And I think that over the course of the winter, when we didn't see a continuation of these offensives by the Ukrainians winning further ground, when we saw the Russians training the troops that they had mobilized, stabilizing the front line, and then mounting some offensives of their own, I think that that may have actually shifted in a negative direction some of the beliefs which many people in the West had about what was going to happen in the war. So instead of it being, you know, like a very decisive Ukrainian victory, as it seemed after Kharkiv, now it looks more like a stalemate. And then, of course, you get sort of various voices saying, well, you know, if it's going to be a stalemate, let's end it. Let's give Russia some of what it wants, and so on. And, you know, Russia hearing this, you know, thinks, well, you know, maybe our strategy is going to work.
So
what Biden is doing.
You've got to be
really
careful here, don't you? Because you're always talking to, when you're talking publicly, you're always talking to the enemy as well.
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe there's people from the Russian embassy listening to what we're saying right now. Wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's public domain. So, you know, maybe check on the viewing figures. Exactly. Yeah. Slavia Ukraini, if they are listening. But I mean, yeah, you know, so what Biden is basically doing is saying, you know, on my watch, at the very least, we are going to keep going, and we're going to keep providing, you know, Ukraine with weaponry. We're not going to allow Ukraine to fall. So, yeah, I think it is important from that point of view, because I think it's stiffening, I think, the resolve of, you know, certain people, both in the United States and in other Western countries, who might have thought that, you know, perhaps the war is, you know, going to grind on, and maybe we should just kind of cut our losses and give Russia some kind of a deal that will allow them to claim victory, basically.
Yeah, but this is that sort of argument that all wars end in, you know, back to your point about the continuum, all where wars end in negotiation, in politics of something. You know, politics eventually comes back in as the way in which wars tend to end, right? And so you see this kind of mentioned quite a lot in reportage around the place, perhaps less so in the last fortnight than say a month before that, again, which also goes to your point about the kind of sense of stalemate. You know, obviously the Russians are going to take some comfort from that, because they're going to think, well, you know, there's a sort of a consensus building, a kind of an acceptance that that perhaps we can reach some sort of negotiated agreement. But of course, to get to that negotiated position, to be able to sit at that table and have any sort of leverage, you need to be in a very strong position. And sides feel that, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. Both sides still feel that they have a path to victory on the battlefield. And when you have that, you can't really have negotiations. You know, any kind of negotiations are only going to begin.
It's a real sweet spot though, isn't it? You could have either sort of stalemate.
Yeah.
Or you could have the sense that we can actually win this. And what you're looking for, if you're interested in that negotiated outcome, is something that probably sits between those two positions.
That's true. I mean, look, I think it's important to stress that not all wars end in negotiations. A substantial proportion of wars end in negotiations. Some wars end with a complete victory of one side or the other. I mean, World War II did, very famously.
Yes.
Some wars end in a sort of a tacit truce, if you like. There's no formal negotiation, no formal peace treaty. So there's never been a formal peace treaty in Korea, for example, which is, I think, a very
technically don't end.
Right, exactly. So I mean, they don't all
No, that's a fair point.
But, I mean, you know, a substantial proportion of them do, that's true.
Well, let's face it, an end to this conflict that doesn't end in a negotiation isn't desirable. You know, we're talking about a frozen conflict on one hand or a total capitulation of one state in these two antagonists. Like, neither of those are a great outcome, right?
Well, I don't know. Here's where I would actually disagree because... So if you listen to Yulia Yoffe, have you heard of Yulia Yoffe?
No.
Okay, so she's a Russian-American journalist, born and raised in Russia, immigrated to the United States relatively young, works for a variety of different publications, New Yorker, she has her own media now. She very frequently appears on American television talking about Putin and Russia. And the point that she makes is that if there's a negotiated settlement, then... Russia will simply see this as being a sort of a pause
placeholder.
Where they can get there, a placeholder where they can catch their breath and go again when things are more, let's say, propitious for them in the future, right? So, I mean, the Minsk Agreement after the invasion of the Donbass and Crimea, for instance, that effectively was that. So, you know, right. You had this kind of negotiations to end the war then, which the Russians basically took as a placeholder to wait and have another go at Ukraine in a few years' time. So her argument is that if you really want to see a genuinely stable, lasting peace between Russia and Ukraine, what you actually have to have is a pretty decisive defeat of Russia, because that's the only way to get them to leave Ukraine alone.
I know. I accept your argument, but I guess I don't really see a situation in which you do see the kind of total capitulation that we saw, for example, in Germany or Japan in 1945 in the case of the Russian Federation. Like, it's just... so enormous, like as a landmass, you know, as a population. Like, I don't really see, without a full-scale war with NATO, how that actually happens.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Sorry. So I should have been a little bit, perhaps a little bit more precise in that. And, you know, I attributed this argument to Yulia Yoffe, but I agree with it myself. So, you know, it should take.
Yeah. I can see why it's true, right? Like,
right.
As the regime currently is, there's really no reason for them to sort of change the pattern of behaviour that's been established for, well, since 1999.
Can I just jump in here? I mean, it seems to me that if we think about, say, the big one, the Second World War, obviously it didn't end in negotiation, it ended in total victory, right? But it ends in total victory on the enemy's territory, right?
Okay.
So, we're not talking about Ukraine invading Russia.
No. So, absolutely. So this is what, so this is what I should really clarify. Which is basically a decisive victory for Ukraine would essentially be one in which the Russian army is dealt a very, very serious defeat on Ukrainian soil, large numbers of casualties or hopefully more likely prisoners of war who surrender, something essentially on this, something very much like the Kharkiv offensive, but on a much larger scale,
and pushes. And presumably bolstered by Putin being so discredited that he is removed
perhaps,
by his own people.
Perhaps.
I mean, because if he's still there and he's not discredited, then there's a political, you know, there's a pent-up political kind of pressure to go again.
There is, but there's a danger. I mean, I don't think that we can really count on Putin being removed. It would be great if it were to happen. I would be very happy if it were to happen.
Well, I reckon a comprehensive defeat of the kind we're talking about might go some way towards increasing that.
But let me so the example I think about is the Soviet-Polish War in the early 1920s. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not like when it comes to wars, I don't know if you can use the term household name, but it's not one that's very well known by many people outside of Poland, really. But what happened there was you had the Soviet Union invading Poland, and then actually very similar in many ways. You know, most people believed that the Poles were going to be defeated and, you know, destroyed quite quickly. And the Poles actually recovered and inflicted a very serious, severe defeat on the Red Army outside of Warsaw and basically pushed the Soviets out of Polish territory to the point where they didn't try again until 1939 when they had the Germans on their side. So I'm thinking something more along the lines of that. So basically then you have this large-scale defeat of Putin's army. You've got the Russians pushed back to their 2013 borders. And then what you have is the Russian army being so degraded in terms of its losses, not just of men, but also of material, also prisoners and so on, experienced cadres, officers, NCOs, that it would be very, very difficult of them for them to try anything again for many, many years. If that means that Putin's gone, great. If it doesn't, however, at least if he's suffered those kind of losses that make it hard for him to try again, then for me, that's a good outcome. And I would defend that point.
Let's take a quick break there and be back in just a moment.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. You're with Democracy Sausage, of course, but of course you already know that. It comes to you from the Australian National University each week. We're talking with Dr. Charles Miller. With me is Dr. Maria Tafalaga as well. Now, where were we, Maria? You wanted to continue on a point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that makes a lot more sense to me as a sense of like what a resounding victory would look like, because that's essentially Ukraine asserting its, you know, dominance and control of its borders, its sovereignty and its monopoly on violence within its borders,
exactly,
right,
yep.
To sort of talk about it in brass tacks terms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that thanks for clarifying that.
One of the limits of the analogy, though, is that this is a war that is being fought by Ukraine for Ukrainian territory, strongly backed by a host of other allies, by NATO, by Australia, by other countries, and that's a really interesting dynamic as well, because, and this goes back to where we started this discussion, Joe Biden's visit to Kyiv and what that says. We've discussed this before. Everyone knows this sort of basic limitation of this, which is that there's a whole lot of people with very strong interests in, or countries with very strong interests in this war, but they're not fighting it themselves.
Yeah.
The Ukrainians are fighting it, but they're doing so with a lot of materiel, with a lot of assistance and moral support from the the democratic world in particular. It's interesting, I think, that Biden's presence at that time, at this time, right on the sort of anniversary of the war, really does. I mean, yes, there aren't American troops on the ground, but there are many American armaments on the ground, a lot of American technology, a lot of American funds, and now the president himself, his boots have been on the ground.
Yeah, right.
And I'm interested in your thoughts about whether that, if we look at it, like looking at the whole circumference of his options here, he's really closed off any possibility of America being able to step away from this, hasn't he?
I don't think he has in one sense. That I don't think he's really, by doing this, committed America to saying that Ukraine has to be able to do what I've outlined. So basically pushing Russia back to its 2013 borders. I don't think he's committed to that. Mm. What he has committed to is to ensuring that Ukraine remains an independent state that is free from Russian domination. That's what he's committed to.
But not necessarily, to the pre-Crimea
yes,
borders.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Mm. So I think he has committed the United States up to a point at least, but not necessarily going all the way.
Do you think it changes? What do you think, Maria? Do you think this sort of changes the overall dynamics here? You know, I mean, Putin's always been saying that, you know, he's essentially fighting the West anyway, that, you know, that it's a sort of a moot point whether Western troops are on the ground, NATO troops are on the ground. He sees this as a kind of a war with NATO in some ways. And and Putin's kind of Biden's kind of confirmed that, you know, by being there and saying we're with you all the way. You know, there's no ambiguity about it, is there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think like if you just think about where we were, like almost a year ago to the day, this is an enormous distance that the US president has traveled, right?
Absolutely.
And I guess I am actually kind of interested in what you think, Charlie, about like the implications for NATO, because that was such an important part about, you know, why they couldn't offer an aerial defense system, the main kind of moral argument the Russians made for this war in the first place, you know, the expansion of NATO, you know, onto our, you know, in our backyard. Is this visit tied or to this conflict, to drawing in NATO? I'm sure Putin will argue that it is, but like in reality, is it?
Does it make it more likely that Ukraine will join NATO?
Well, no. I mean, like, yeah, I suppose, but I guess what I'm really asking inarticulately is Biden's visit like, an important stepping stone to this becoming a full-on Russia versus NATO kind of war, or is that just histrionics?
No, I don't think it's a stepping stone to becoming a full-on Russia versus NATO war. No, I mean, first of all, a number of NATO leaders have already been to Kyiv. So Boris Johnson, Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz. Also, I mean, there's been a number of senior members of the US government, not necessarily Biden himself. So Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the House, Senate Majority Leaders and so on. So, I mean, I don't think it necessarily commits the United States to putting boots on the ground or even playing aircraft over the skies of Ukraine. But I think it does commit the United States to doing whatever it can short of that to maintain Ukrainian independence.
Yeah, but it's a fascinating dimension, this, because the politics of this leading up to the war was all about that argument, as Marie was making the point, all about that argument of encroachment, that NATO was flirting with the idea, leading, gesturing to Ukraine that Ukraine might be granted membership of NATO. And Putin used that domestically, is NATO encroaching right up to a Russian border, that, you know, that whole sphere of influence thing that had dominated the Cold War was being breached, with NATO flirting with the idea of Ukraine being a member of NATO. And really, that could be the result of this. We've seen
it could be
Finland and Sweden, for example.
Joining, right. Exactly. I mean, Sweden, we'll see, right? I mean, you know, we've got this potential for a Turkish veto over Swedish membership, which could kind of stall that. But I mean, we have to remember that the idea of Ukrainian membership of NATO had been dead for a long time prior to the war. So that makes it quite difficult for me to buy the idea that that's what actually caused it. Now, perhaps
I'm not saying it caused it, but it was it was used domestically. Didn't need to be actually true.
Right.
Bush had spoken about it in 2008. George W. Bush.
Yeah, he had. Yeah, absolutely, he had spoken about it. But I mean, the idea, like Angela Merkel, pretty much killed off the idea after that, and it had never really kind of been a serious proposition after that point until now. But there is, I think there's a reasonable argument to be made to say that the West should have handled Russia better in the 1990s during the Boris Yeltsin era. So, maybe, now bearing in mind, again, the Baltic countries, which were former members of the Soviet Union, didn't join until the 2000s when Putin was already in power. But nonetheless, the moves to enlarge NATO and to bring in Poland, Hungary and so on and so forth, perhaaps in hindsight, it might have been better to wait until Russian democracy had been consolidated before doing those kind of things. And I think that there is, that is a reasonable argument. In the same way, perhaps, you might want to think that some of the things that the Allies did with respect to Germany in the 1920s before Hitler came to power could have been much more conciliatory towards the Germans, right? So maybe the thing about appeasement is that it wasn't wrong in principle, it was wrong as a policy directed towards Adolf Hitler. But if it had been directed towards the Weimar Republic, it might actually have been a lot more successful. So similarly, right, if The West had been more conciliatory towards Russia's kind of foreign policy and security sensitivities in the 1990s when Russia was, albeit in an abortive way, transitioning towards democracy. And perhaps that would have been a better idea than what it ultimately did. But once Putin got in power, I don't think that appeasement would have worked.
Which was actually a long time ago.
It was very long.
Yeah, it was 1999, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Your analogy to the post World War One settlement really actually underscores for me the economic dimension here, right? Perhaps shock therapy for the Russian economy in the 1990s, was not exactly the best strategy. And for listeners who have no idea what it was like at the fall of the Soviet Union, basically for, 9 or 10 months, no wages were paid in the Soviet Union. People went to work every day because there was nothing else to do, but no one was actually getting paid. If you go to Russia now, you'll sort of see that all the apartment blocks have heavy duty steel doors on them, which, and that is because, the place was a Wild West and people would just take drills or even just screwdrivers, take the door off your house and just steal everything. So I mean, you can kind of actually sort of see why there is a sort of siege mentality in Russian politics and why this war, which is going so badly, is so disturbing, right? Because it invokes memories of the Great Patriotic War, which in Russia runs from 1941 to 1945, not 1939, right? And every year there is a big blockbuster about glorifying that war in the way that every year there is a show in the UK about the Blitz.
Or the Battle of Britain.
And the Battle of Britain, right? So, all these countries are sort of reinforcing these are the greatest days of our nation kind of narratives. And so, it doesn't really matter in to go back to the NATO point, it often doesn't even matter if these things are true or not. People believe they are true.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of affects I guess what is possible to argue. And I'm just rambling now. I'm going to stop. So now.
I was going to make a point that we should commemorate the great toilet paper shortage of 2020 as
Oh, my God. That was brutal.
I'm still shell-shocked from that.
I still buy about 5 value packs every time I go to the shops just in case. I think our generation always will.
It's like
it's our finest hour.
Yes, I know, exactly.
But go back to your point about all of those ex-Eastern Bloc states and their inclusion in NATO. It's a really interesting one because it does, when you look at what that induction in, I think in 2008, of all of those states, you're talking about Estonia, Bulgaria, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, whole range of those countries. Right. It does read like a list of the buffer states of the former Soviet Union, and that was the way it was seen. Right?
Yeah.
And Ukraine, bordering on Russia.
Well, the word literally means periphery. On the edge.
Yeah. And that's the way it's being used. And, there's an argument that as you know, in international relations about, understanding balancing it into balance and understanding how things are seen as not just how you see them, but how the other side sees them and how they are perceived. And what narratives you enliven in that process. And clearly Putin's been very effective at running this argument that essentially, there's a containment strategy of the former Soviet Union. Just like China runs that narrative about the Quad, for example, that it's a containment strategy.
Exactly. Well, I think and this is where I would probably start to diverge a little bit from a lot of my kind of fellow hawks on this war in terms of what the sort of long-term strategy would be. Let's imagine in the situation where Russia transitions back to being a more democratic country, say Putin's got rid of, he ends up against a wall like Nikolai Ceausescu or some such, and, say Alexei Navalny is swept into power and, reinstalls Russia's democracy and so on. I think under those conditions, I mean, the Ukrainians, quite understandably, and many of the other Eastern Europeans would still want to have NATO really close. They would still fear Russia. That wouldn't be the end of it for them. Whereas I actually think then in that situation, the priority for the West would actually be to solidify democracy in Russia, because I think in the long run, that would be the best guarantor of the security and safety of the Ukrainians and the Polans and the Bulgarians and so on. And by being, you know, more kind of, I suppose, taking a more short-term view of things and saying, okay, well, we don't, you know, again, I'm talking hypothetically, but by saying, you know, well, we don't know if this is going to last, you know, like they could have another Putin-like dictator come back in a few years' time. So let's, you know, continue to treat Russia with suspicion and mistrust. I think that's the point where I think that the interests maybe or the behaviours of, you know, Western countries like the United States or Britain and so forth towards Russia, and those of the Eastern European countries, including Ukraine, that have a hawkish attitude towards Russia, that's where it might begin to diverge. But right now, I think that our interests and theirs are pretty closely aligned.
Yeah. Let's shift from the kind of this kind of loftier,
absolutely,
the sort of global politics of it all, the strategic policy, to the actual battlefields, right? So we've had some pretty interesting developments in recent times. Zelensky himself has really stepped up the sort of calls for, the requests, the demands for extra support. And there's a new urgency in his messaging, and I think it's an entirely valid urgency, where he is saying to NATO leaders, to Western supporters, delays themselves are our enemy here. We can't afford, you know, the eking this out, you know, dribs and drabs of support here, of ammunition and so forth. Understand, you know, your own limitations and all that, but if we're going to survive this and prevail, we need it now. And he recently has secured all those tanks, but he's got 31 Abrams tanks coming from the US, I think 14 of the Leopard 2 coming, that Germany took some time to agree to supply and to allow some of those other countries I mentioned before that have been supplied, Estonia, those sort of countries, to provide Leopard 2 tanks, and the Brits are supplying Challenger tanks as well. So that's interesting. Interested in hearing your thoughts about that, and also about the next level, which of course is this request for fighter aircraft.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm, like I say, I personally, I don't, you know, go out on a limb here and say that I'm in favor of really giving Ukraine what it is asking for. I don't think that we should really observe too many limits here, because I think that we can't, first of all, guarantee what's going to happen on the battlefield given a particular level of support. You cannot fine-tune war to that degree.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like we can say, well, you know, we'll give them tanks but not fighter aircraft, and so therefore this will guarantee that they'll advance X kilometres. That's not how it works. I mean, one of the things that does worry me a little bit is that we don't necessarily know what the kind of losses are that the Ukrainians have sustained and the danger that they may be in of basically being ground down via attrition. So I think that we should give them what they are looking for, to not guarantee, but try and reduce as much as possible the risk of a really, really bad outcome, like the Ukrainian army being ground down almost to the point of collapse. I think we need to make sure that that doesn't happen. And also to give Ukraine the best chance possible of bringing about the end state that I was talking about earlier, of basically defeating the Russians decisively and expelling them from all of Ukraine, not just the bits that they've taken.
Because you've got the effect of those weapons, but you've also got the effect of the commitment.
Yes, you know? There's the effect of the commitment. Yeah, exactly. And the, you know, the message that it sends. But I think the weapons in and of themselves are pretty damn important.
Yeah.
Because the Russians have more men than the Ukrainians do. Both sides probably now are staffed in the majority by people who were not professional soldiers prior to the start of the war. So I think that the capabilities of both of the armies will have gone down to some degree. So I don't think that we can imagine that the Ukrainians are these kind of super soldiers that we made them out to be at the end of the war, the end of last year after the Kharkiv offensive. So I think we should give them what they're asking for, and the hope being basically that we will end up with this maximally good situation of Russia being expelled, and reduce to as much as possible the really bad situation of Ukraine being ground down.
Do you think Australia should do more?
I mean, yeah, if we can. I don't think ultimately that Australia can really make that much of a difference in this kind of situation. I mean, I'm sorry to say, but, you know, we're not really that big or powerful a country. So what the United States or Germany or France or Britain does is much more important than what we do. But insofar as we've got things that we can send to the Ukrainians, I think we should.
Well, Charles, it's been terrific talking to you again as we approach this fateful anniversary, this unfortunate anniversary of this appalling war. So thanks again for checking in with us. I hope we can talk to you again soon, and hopefully we'll be talking about an ongoing trajectory of improvement. But we are on the edge, of course, or we're coming to the end of February, which means we're coming to the end of the Ukrainian or Northern Hemisphere winter. And there's much trepidation about what happens from here. We know the Russians are likely to launch some pretty big offensives. They're using Iranian drones and all kinds of things. I noticed that the Israelis are talking about providing their David's sling sort of drone and missile defense systems in Ukraine for Ukraine. There are many dynamics here, and this could get uglier before it gets better.
It could indeed. I mean, one thing I would say, though, with regards to the Russian offensive, Michael Friedman, who, again, like for me, is the best person to listen to if you want to, really understand what's going on in the Ukraine war. So the War on the Rocks podcast is what you would listen to for that one. He says that basically the offensive that is going on just now is the offensive, the bigger. There's not some other bigger one that's coming along later. That's quite a big statement to make, but I mean, he does know what he's talking about. So I would really, I would tend to lend a lot of credence to that assessment.
Hope he's right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. That's Democracy Sausage for this week. As you know, it comes to you from the Australian National University, and we'll be back next week, and I think we'll be talking about the big lie. With a very eminent
Should I believe
scientist.
You, Mark? But I'm ching.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.